Echo Plus.
Hello and welcome to Echo Plus programme. My name's John Harrison. Today we're going to talk about whether food, the stuff we eat every day, should be securitized. That is, whether government should be taking extreme measures to ensure that the world's populations get enough to eat, bearing in mind that 1 in 8 of us on this planet are undernourished. Joining me today to talk about this and other related issues is Greg Barrow, the director of the World Food Programme's London office. Now, the World Food Programme, if you don't know, was founded in 1961, and it's the food assistance branch of the United Nations and the world's largest humanitarian organisation addressing hunger and food security. Welcome to the programme, Greg.
Good morning. Hello. Actually, let me just say hello.
Okay. Can you tell us all, first of all, please, a little bit about the World Food Programme, or WFP, for those of us who maybe don't know too much about it or have never heard of it, in fact?
Sure. I think you've painted a brief picture there of the history of the organisation. It's a little over 50 years old, yeah. And it's really an organisation that was set up to respond to what we call emergency food needs. Mm-hmm. These are the food needs of populations that are in distress, either because of a natural disaster like an earthquake, a flood or a drought, or perhaps because they've been caught up in some sort of human conflict, such as we're seeing in Syria in the Middle East region at the moment. What that means these days is that most of our work feeding around 80 to 90 million people every year in more than 70 countries across the world is in response to these kinds of emergencies. But alongside these emergencies, we then, after the critical phase of the emergency, try to help communities get back on their own 2 feet, build resilience, and allow them to, in a sense, meet their own food needs. So there's a sort of emergency response and then a sort of more developmental resilience-based aftermath in which we're involved often for many, many months with communities that live in these areas of the world but are chronically vulnerable to crises, natural disasters.
That's amazing. You do incredible work, incredibly important work. Now, is the global situation getting better? I mean, I read recently that the amounts of actual wars, you know, country-to-country wars rather than wars happening inside countries, are reducing in number, meaning that there's less conflicts internationally than there used to be, say, 50 years ago, for example. Is your work, therefore, becoming easier? Are there less problems to clean up than before, or is it getting worse?
Well, there are several ways that you can look at this. I'm sure you and your listeners are aware of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, which set a number of key targets, humanitarian targets, that should be met by 2015, so we're approaching the target date very, very soon.
Yeah.
As far as hunger is concerned, the target was to reduce by half the proportion of hungry people around the world. And there has been some success on that front. Some countries have met those targets, and there is a perception that if a lot of work is continued in the last few months, then largely speaking, obviously there will be exceptions, the world will just about meet that target. We don't know for sure that it will, but it can't be ruled out at the moment. And there's another organization that the World Food Programme works very closely with called the Food and Agriculture Organization.
Yep.
This is an organization that really monitors the number of hungry people around the world. And every year in October, they publish new figures. This year, they published a set of figures that showed that the number of hungry people around the world had dropped from around 840 million last year to a little over 800 million this year. Now, that's still a huge amount of people, and amongst that group, there will be people who have been affected by conflict and war. And you're right to point out that wars, generally speaking, in this day and age, tend to be more within countries rather than between countries. But that doesn't mean that they're any less damaging to the communities who live there. But I should add, I think one of the much bigger issues that we're grappling with is the impact of climate change, which happens globally, and what one can do about that.
And I was going to ask you actually about that question. In the UK, we've had a very high food inflation over the last few years. It was over 5% in 2012. And I've read lots of reports saying the major cause of this is because raw materials, food, are becoming more expensive because of climate change. Now, if it's affecting us in the rich North, it must be playing havoc in the South.
Yes, I think it's very fair to say that as far as climate change is concerned, it's felt all over the world.
Yeah.
But for us in the Northern Hemisphere and in the largely developed and industrialized nations of the world, we have so much more in the way of mechanisms that we can use to protect ourselves or insulate ourselves from the impact of it. And one of the sort of great sort of sad ironies about climate change and its impact on global populations is that as things stand at the moment, it is largely the industrialized nations who are responsible for the industry that has produced a situation where climate change is having an impact. But while we are responsible in these nations, it is the vulnerable poor people living in developing countries who are least protected from it and feel its greatest impact, because this is being felt in areas of the world like the Sahel region in West Africa or the Horn of Africa in the east of the continent, in the east of sub-Saharan continent. This change is affecting communities that are largely subsistence farmers who are generally in any given year producing just about enough food to feed themselves. And it only takes a sort of small change in terms of the pattern of rainfall or increase in temperature to have a massive impact on their levels of production and thereby have a huge impact on the nutrition, food security and health of their families.
So although the horrendous figures are coming down from 840 million to 800 million, and I'm just trying to work out what 800 million people means. I mean, you take a country like the UK, you're talking about 10 times the population of the UK or something. I mean,
it's
completely incomprehensible.
One in nine people around the world.
So while we
can pat ourselves on the back to say those numbers are coming down, they still need to come down a lot more.
And
judging by
what you've just been telling us, they could be going up again a lot quicker. I mean, one way of looking at the situation would be to say, yes, we've got better in coping with the present situation, but if the present situation should tip over and become dramatically worse because of climate change, would we be able to cope then? Let's carry on our conversation after a short break.
Echo Plus.
Welcome back to Echo Plus programme. Today I'm talking to Greg Barrow, the director of the World Food Programme's London office. We're talking about the whole situation about showing food production, distribution. Is this something that should be securitized? And I'm going to ask you that very question now, Greg. What about the future? What about if the population keeps on rising to over 9 billion by 2050 and the climate situation deteriorates so quickly, so rapidly that we can't keep up? Do you think this is something that government should get together and sort out or not?
I think we should be grateful that governments are taking this seriously, and there have been some recent wake-up calls that have really focused global attention. If we look back to 2008, there was a global high food price crisis around the world that sparked riots in some countries, and in some places such as Haiti led to the fall of a government. And I think this sort of made many, many governments realize that this is an issue that needs close attention. So I think the good thing we can say is that there is an awareness this is an issue that just can't be left to sort itself out. That said, I think there is a general consensus that as long as one can keep a close eye on the market and on forecasting where there might be potential problems, trying to limit the impact of market speculation. Generally speaking, the free market system has served the world reasonably well. I think as we talked, there are sort of game changers here, such as the impact of climate change, and we have to work very, very closely with communities that live in those areas of the world that are exposed to the pernicious effects of climate change to help them introduce buffers that allow them to cope with the ups and downs of changing patterns of weather.
Yeah.
And we also have to address other issues. I mean, I think one of the sort of simplest and most effective ways of addressing any potential shortage of food is to look at food waste and the amount of food, not just that is purchased and then thrown away before it's consumed. Something like 30% of all food in industrialized nations is thrown away before it's eaten. but also in the food producing countries, in developing countries, the amounts of food that is wasted after harvest because there's a lack of storage facilities. Again, that's about 30%. So if you look at it that way, you can have a massive, massive impact on the supply of food by taking some fairly simple measures. It's not sort of really rocket science on that front.
It's not really a good idea, is it, food production and distribution is securitized, because the word securitization to me means something to do with military, you know, with tanks and armies and things like that. What the option that you're suggesting sounds a lot better to me, that we work with what we have and we push improving what systems we already have in place. They serve our needs better, and one of them is cutting down on food wastage. But would you agree with me that there are problems with the global international, the globalization situation of the planet, as the planet's economies and the ability of our nations as a global community to sort out individual problems?
Well, when it comes to food security, it is a challenge, yes, without a doubt, given this array of issues that we're having to address. I think the existence of organizations like the World Food Programme, like the Food and Agriculture Organization, and other agencies of the UN is evidence in itself that you need to have groups that are taking care of this, taking attention, drawing attention to it, and making sure that it stays high on the global political agenda. But also, I would also say that I don't want to sort of argue that this is only about food and food supply. It's about infrastructure, it's about investment, it's about access to technology, it's about improving access to markets in developing countries. You take a country where the World Food Programme is working at the moment, South Sudan, one of the newest countries in the world. There are hardly any car covered roads in South Sudan. It's just a few hundred kilometres. It's really very, very fundamental things that we need to address, particularly in the poorest and least developed countries of the world.
Those fundamental issues, should they perhaps not be securitised, but another word, commercialised? Is there a way that organisations like the one that you represent, you work for, and United Nations and other international organisations can somehow motivate entrepreneurs internationally to take part in programs that will improve infrastructures in various countries?
Well, it's a very interesting point. Increasingly, many humanitarian agencies work in partnership with big private sector corporations on a number of issues, and that is happening. But I think sort of more broadly speaking, what we can look at is the role of agencies like the World Food Programme as a sort of catalyst that creates an enabling environment that then encourages the private sector to come in. It may be too much to expect the private sector to sort of address the fundamental issues in Sudan, but at the same time, it's probably too much to expect an agency like the World Food Programme to do everything that's necessary to kickstart that economy. But if we can play a sort of catalytic role, that creating the sort of spark that generates the interest in greater investment in a country like South Sudan, then there is some hope on that front.
A lot of people are saying that internationally, politically speaking, we're reaching a sort of interesting point in time where we see the world sort of splitting into two groups, with the BRICS and ASEAN countries on one side and everybody else on the other. World Food Programme, is it really a World Food Programme? Or is it a programme that's only looking after the interests of a part of the world, if you see what I mean? I'm speaking very simple, general terms here.
I think the situation is evolving all the time, and what we see now with splitting of the world into different camps, as you characterise, won't necessarily be the same in 1 year, 5 year, or even 10 years' time. And I think the thing that you can say about the World Food Programme is it exists to address the needs of the hungriest people in the world, even in some of the fast-developing countries among those that you mentioned, places like Brazil, India and China, is the vast inequalities within those societies. So you have growing economies moving in the right direction, but then within those countries, and this is certainly the case of Brazil, you have levels of food insecurity and malnutrition that in some cases are approaching what we see in parts of sub-Saharan Africa. So we are going to have to work within some of these countries, and we may see a shift of the World Food Programme's work towards addressing the food needs of the hungriest people in middle-income countries, just these small pockets.
Your work seems to cut across all sorts of political, geographical, emotional, intellectual boundaries. Absolutely fantastic. Very interesting talking to you, Greg. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you, listeners, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.